Explain gardening for the Gulf Coast with Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Hey, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. It's a morning when we have many mothers to be thankful for when it comes to our gardening. And I think about that a lot. I will say it's, I feel bad right now spending time with you when I should be spending time with my mother in her garden. Boy, does she want me to be down there to see her garden in full bloom. She reminds me all the time, and when I call her this afternoon, she's going to say, I don't know why you're not here to see my garden. She's very proud of that garden. She spends a lot of time there. And, you know, I learned a lot about gardening from her, and I think often about where did she get her interest in gardens? They're very different than mine. I mean, it's interesting. Her interest in what grows, I think about that, is not always the same as mine. She has very little interest in producing food. She used to, but that was kind of Dad's thing. Hers was just about being ornamental, right? just the pretty stuff. And that was fine, and that was very influential for me. And I loved it. And it's interesting to think the things that the plants that she was so in love with, you don't hear me talking about as much, like daylilies. I can't tell you why, what happened to me. It just, something just turned off in me about daylilies, and that's a terrible thing on my part, I'm sure. And one of these days I'm going to revisit it. That's not something you should learn from me. It's just something just didn't click anymore. But she loves her daylilies. She loves all of the other plants she's planted. I do think there's one thing that we share in common, and that's when we go out and we look at a yard. My mother and me, when we go out and look at that, look at those yards, we don't think, oh gosh, what am I going to do to make this grass better? I didn't think about the grass. I'm just walking across it. I want it to be nice to walk across, you know? But it's a destination. There's a destination there, and the grass is only a path to get to that place. It's not just me. That's to blame for this weird concept. It will seem weird to you because grass has become a destination, a weird destination. It's because we like to go see something interesting. We like for our destinations to be interesting. We like for them to be pretty or useful. The grass is not the destination in her yard. It's those pretty flowers. It's those wonderful things. And she's always arranging landscapes. Sometimes she forgets to think about how the land itself shapes what plants she can grow, but she figures it out. She makes it work over the long haul, and it's really cool. Where did she get this from? And I think about this. Why was she so interested in this? Why was she so interested? And I think about her mother, whose interest in gardens was limited, but her grandmother Grace, in a little place. It was a funky little, I guess you could call it an estate. It was a compound, a family compound out in Clinton, Mississippi. And I remember Grandmother Grace's rambling house. It was built, started in the Depression. It was like from the worst of times and just added on to over the years until it actually became a really interesting house. I remember it vividly. And I also remember outside of Grandmother Grace's house, this incredible landscape that wasn't about grass. It wasn't about showing off the grass. It wasn't even about emphasizing the grass. In many cases, the grounds were unmowed, and they had that beautiful, beautiful orange hue in fall on the outer edges from the native grasses blooming around the edges and leaving those stalks up. But it was these destinations in the gardens, the places where the crab apples were, which were something to see, and the places with the vegetable garden, and the places with the little patio garden that was in a shady area. They were, my great grandmother Grace was a member of the Garden Clubs of America. This was something she cherished. This was something she did. And I'm sure that's where that influenced my mother, that sense of looking, walking to see something beautiful. Walking to see something beautiful in your lawn. And Grandmother Grace also inspired another fella. I wish he were still around. We would have lots to talk about nowadays. We kind of grew up together. John DeLashmet, Jack DeLashmet, one of my cousins, and Jack went on to design landscapes in the Hamptons. and I could see in those landscapes that he designed great-grandmother Grace's property, her vision. I guess we both kind of grew up with that, as did my mother. And we all learned from those things, those many mothers. I miss seeing my mother's garden. I really need to get down to do that. If you have a chance to go see your mother's garden today, you should go do that. You should tell her how pretty it is. There's another mother that was very influential in my garden. And it was the mother I met when I was roaming in the woods, deep in the woods of Mississippi and Alabama. Just not knowing where I was going, not knowing what I was going to see, worried about worried about whether I was going to get back, delighted not to have to get back. It's that mother that created these wetlands and these woodlands that I came to love. And I think about that and how that has influenced how I see gardens. The necessity of seeing not just what I can build, not just how I can change a landscape, but what that landscape can tell me about how I live. Sometimes I think even remembering the best of the garden landscapes that I've created, and that Jack DeLashmet, my famous cousin, who designed landscapes in the Hamptons, and my great-grandmother Grace and my mother, they all created beautiful gardens. But I think they all had a sense that there was another place, there was another garden, another mother creating gardens too. And these were gardens that were more thoughtful, deeper, ultimately more beautiful, more productive than anything we could design ourselves. And we thought there must be lessons in those gardens. I could see it in Jack's landscapes. Yeah, he made a living. You have to make a living, right? And he loved being popular in the Hamptons. But his landscapes continually refer to the wild places he saw on the edge of Grandmother Grace's property, to those wild places in the Big Black and in the Mississippi Delta and down in South Mississippi that he grew up with around Wiggins. Those beautiful, beautiful native landscapes. It's another mother we should honor this morning when we're thinking about gardens and we're thinking about the people who create gardens. I hope you'll visit both those gardens. Your mother's garden, the mother who raised you, who changed your diapers, and the other mother, the mother who raised us all. We'll be talking more about that. You give me a call this morning, 251-343-0106.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Go, Bill.
All right. Welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning. Alabama Sunday morning. So I'm kidding. I'm getting pictures without text, so I'm not sure what to do with the pictures yet. Maybe things are slow. Maybe it's this. Maybe it's a solar flare. I don't know. But I'm trying to get to your pictures. Don sent me a picture. Don, I don't see any type with it. Try it again, Don, with just the type. I'm not sure what. There's a picture of a tree, but I'm not sure what you're asking. Kathy, if you can, let's see here. I am not getting your picture in. It may be too big. Reduce the size of that picture just a little bit and send it to me. And it's a picture. Can you tell me what this is? But there's nothing with it. So, Kathy, try that again. Let's see here. Bill, could you identify this tree? It makes small apples that never get much bigger than 2 inches, 2.5 inches. So it's a couple of possibilities. When you see an apple with smaller apples, these are kind of elongated, and I can't tell when they're immature like that. It would be very hard to tell if it is a cultivar of an apple. What I'm told is that these apples tend to fall off, but they have a fairly good flavor, and they never turn red. There are a number of green apples out there that are cultivars that were deliberately created. I will say that a lot of apples that may persist in gardens maybe apples from the graft, from the rootstock of the graft. So when we just as with citrus and just as with a number of trees that we use for fruits, we may find a tree that's producing very good fruit, and we want to propagate that, increase that tree. We don't usually do it by seeds anymore, because there's a lot of problem with seeds. They may not be exactly like the mother. I love my mother, but I'm not exactly like her, right? So we clone, and you can do this with plants. It's harder with people, possible perhaps, but very hard. We clone. We clone plants, and so one of the ways we clone them is to take a cutting from the tree that's producing the fruit we like very much and to weld that on to the rootstock of another apple, for example, or another citrus that has much better root system. And we do that a lot with apples, and there are many benefits to that in terms of how the apple grows and how it produces, and certainly its survivability, and certainly your ability to propagate it. But sometimes we lose the top, and all we're left with is the rootstock, and the rootstock continues to grow, and you might get these little crabapple-like things. It could be that's what you're getting. Could be that's what you're getting, though these are kind of big for crabapples, I agree. But it could be it's the rootstock, so I can't rule that out. The fact that the fruits are dropping and they're still quite good suggests that it's, I don't know, maybe a cultivar. But I can't identify it right now. I'll think about it. One thing you can do to help me with this apple is to tell me where you found this apple, if it looks like it's been planted recently. there's a bunch of apples out there, a bunch of them, thousands of apples, varieties. And in the South, we could easily meet with several hundred, a couple or 300 varieties at old places. In at newer, if it's more newly planted, it makes it easier because I know that you don't have as much variety as the old as we used to in the South where apples are concerned. We should talk about apples someday. Maybe I will. But send me a little more information. Where is this apple? Where is the apple? Does it look like it's freshly planted? And one other thing you can do is check around the base and see if if it looks like it lost its head, it lost its top, about 6 inches above the ground should be a little welded, a welded place, a little knot, where the top emerges from the bottom, from that weld. And you'll see the weld. It's a little knot. If you see a top coming out of that weld, out of that little knot, about 6 to 8 inches above ground, then I know that it is a cultivar. It's a true apple, and it'll have a name, perhaps. If you don't see that, if you don't see things emerging above that knot, things look like they're emerging straight out of the ground, then I'm going to say it's something else. So you'll have to do those. That's your homework. You can do it now during the show and send it back to me. Where's the apple from? Do you know a history about its planting? Where did you see it? History of its planting, and what do you see on the rootstock? And then I'll be able to help. All right, here we go. Charlie, you say we've got a caller? Kevin, I'm listening. What's up, buddy?
Bill, good morning. Thank you. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Kevin?
The question I have is that, can you hear me?
Yeah, now I can hear you. There you go.
Okay.
What's
great,
up?
Great. So the question I have is, we are down in Orange Beach and had a dredge guy come and dredge up a bunch of sand from the boat lift to get it to where we can get the boat in there. We spread the sand around the yard and was wondering, we were going to try to put some sod on top of it. And didn't know if we needed to wait until the salt got out of it, or if it wasn't going to affect sod, or what should we do on that?
Mm. Well, it's probably not the best thing to grow plants on, but it would work. Yeah, how long ago did you haul that sod out? Sand out.
Sand. Oh, yeah, this week. This week,
yeah. So I would definitely. Yeah. So, you know, the good thing about our climate is that salt does tend to get leached out pretty readily. Though I would say I would wait a few months. So what are you going to do in the meantime is a really interesting question. I'm not sure that's the best growing medium in the world. Let me talk about that, because you might need to do several things, and this may help you through the wait. The first thing is there's no organic matter in that sand, and believe it or not, it's probably got a lot of silt in it as well. And one of the things that's going to happen is it's going to get hard. It's not going to hold water moisture very well over the long haul, but it's probably going to stay exceedingly wet because the water is going to go through that shallow layer of sand, hit the ground underneath it, and just kind of sit there. So it's going to be the worst of both extremes. So what would I do if I only wanted a lawn? And I, is that the main thing you want there, is just a lawn?
It was just a couple of low areas in the yard that, of course, it's very sandy down here. We were just trying to just build it up a little bit.
Yeah. A little bit in those areas. So how big are those areas?
Oh, you know, it's mainly alongside a driveway or whatever, you know, say 10 feet by 75, 80 feet, something like that.
Okay. All right. Well, that makes things a lot easier. Didn't understand that. So, yeah, I would definitely think about adding organic matter to those areas. One of the things you can do right now is to put a cover crop on it. And that's a little tricky because we don't have a lot of great cover crops for our area that stay low. Do you have any interest? Let me explore this with you. Here's the other problem. It really is a terrible time to put a lawn out. And particularly, you've got to let it get a little bit of salt out of it. So if you want to put lawn in those areas, then I would wait as long as I could. And honestly, I would wait until September, October, when it's much easier to start a lawn. Because if you put the lawn in October, for example, you'll only have to water it once or twice, and then the winter rains are going to take over, and it's going to be fine. You might tomato a little more, but you won't have the big problems that you're going to have this time of year establishing a lawn, because you're going to have lots of lawn diseases, and you need to water, but the watering itself causes more lawn diseases. So it's kind of a weird situation. So if you could, can you wait until fall?
It makes the summer fun. I don't have to plant.
That's right. So I've got to take a break. But let's come back and let's talk about what you can do then.
Along about 1825, I left Tennessee very much alive. And I never would have got through the Arkansas mud if I hadn't been around that Tennessee stud. I had some trouble with my sweetheart's paw, and one of her brothers was a bad outlaw. I sent her a letter by my Uncle Foot, then I rode away on the Tennessee stud. The Tennessee stud was long and lean, the color of the sun, and his eyes were green. He had the nerve and he had the blood, and there never was a horse like the Tennessee stud.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Yeah, all right, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. Kevin, let's get back to your lawn. I had to get some background. You still there, Kevin? Uh-oh. Charlie, is Kevin still there, you think? Oh, dear. Maybe Kevin will call back. Kevin, I hope you're still listening. I think I've got enough background now. Let me say that it will be harder to start the lawn now. And you do need to let that salt leach out just a little bit. One of the things you can do now, if you don't mind, okay, Kevin, you're back. Good. Sorry.
Yeah.
You on there with us?
That's right.
Yeah. Good. So good. I had the background. We can move ahead now. Listen. So in an area like that, you kind of got to figure out what am I going to do during summer, and while I'm waiting to sod this fall, because if you want to sod those areas, if your priority is sodding those areas, it's going to be so much easier to do that in fall. So I would certainly, what are some alternatives? Do you have an HOA where you are?
Yes.
Okay. Are they going to limit what you can plant?
Not necessarily. I mean, they probably wouldn't want me to put a garden in the front yard, but other than that, they're pretty flex.
Yeah. So, oh boy, what are we gonna try? Rye is not going to work. If one thing you can do, and this works really well, is to, if you don't mind doing this, is to plant peas, field peas, in those areas. Their root system is going to really break up that soil. Now, if you've got an HOA and they don't want you planting vegetables in the front yard, just take a string trimmer and mow those peas down about every 2 weeks. And they'll build up that soil really well, and you'll be ready. And they'll be pretty. They'll look pretty, and it's just a ground cover until you can get things done for this fall. And that will really help to make that soil work really, really well. Is that something you could contemplate doing?
I'll look into it and see. It's just, like I said, an area alongside a driveway that we were just trying to build up. And we'll try.
Yeah, here's another solution. And this is a little trickier, but it can work. You're going to need organic matter for that soil. So sand is a really poor thing for soil to grow on. And you know you're going to need organic matter. So one thing you can do, and this may be more acceptable to the HOA, is to come in with about 3 inches of pine bark, each piece no bigger than your fingernail, small pine bark, and you can find that, and just lay it on about 3 to 6 inches deep, anywhere in that distance is fine. And then, this will be great to put the sod over when it's time to put the sod over it, and then you can put in really tough plants. Find some tough plants to put there that grow well in your area, some flowering plants, and just use that as a border area for those flowering plants until you're ready to sod this fall. And that'll help as well, which will be a big benefit. You really don't even have to dig that. You don't even have to dig it in. Just lay that pine bark on top of these areas. And plants will grow right in it as long as it's at least 3 inches deep. And that'll be plenty of room for those plants to grow. You might have to fertilize them just a little bit. Would that be a solution?
That sounds good.
Yeah. Now, no matter how you do it, that pine bark will be necessary when you put the sod on, but you'll be all ready to do it. And if you go ahead and put that on now and get something with a really strong root system and plant it there, I'm trying to think of something you could do from seeds, which would be much cheaper, and I'll have to think about that a little better if you think the peas won't work. But I think the peas will work. If you put that pine bark down, plant the peas in the pine bark, let them come on up, just keep cutting them down. They don't even need a lot of nitrogen. They'll be just fine there. And that will really improve the soil, and that's certainly one way to approach it.
Hey, I like to eat field peas, so hey.
Okay. Yeah, well, if your HOA will allow you to do it, that's the best way to do it. So you'll actually get the peas as well, and I could talk for a long time about which are the best peas. Find some varieties you like. Find some of the tougher varieties. I like the whippoorwill varieties. And there are a lot of them out there. Paget peas, which is a pea that I get from mail order from, I think several people are selling it. Paget peas are good. Any of the whippoorwill peas are good. But, Mississippi silver, peacock purple hulls, whichever. And plant them out there. They'll go ahead and set down in that soil. They'll put roots deep. They'll improve the soil. It's really a great transition crop.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Bill. I appreciate it.
All right. Good to talk to you, Kevin.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, if you tell the HOA that it's a cover crop and not a vegetable, just don't let them. And they have beautiful, a lot of peas. Have y'all ever noticed this? A lot of our peas, our native field peas, have really beautiful flowers on them. And they're blue, and you could just tell them, I'm growing these for the flowers, and I'm going to keep them low, and I'm going to use it to cover crop. I'm going to put lawn here, whatever I'm going to do later. But those peas make a marvelous transition. It actually improves the soil more if you don't let them if you don't let them go to seed, if you don't actually let the peas come on, it'll really improve the soil. But you know what? There's nothing at all wrong. You'll still get plenty of benefits if you grow them for the peas. So either way, really a useful crop, peas are. We could have more useful crops, many more useful crops. We just don't produce them. And it's going to be hard to find the seeds. But that's a good way to transition an area where you've just put in new soil. If you don't want to, if you don't want to have to sod right now, one way to do that. Y'all can call me and we can talk about the details. Let's see here. Let's see. Let me find. Oh, Alicia has got beautiful blossom garlic. And she's pulled it now, and it looks good. You know, here's the thing I say about growing garlic in most of Alabama. We get so much rain that there are disadvantages to leaving the garlic in the ground. A lot of weird things can happen to the garlic when you leave it in the ground for too long. It's one of the reasons why I always recommend garlic that bulbs up before summer gets here. So California silver skin garlics, for example, are often recommended for warm growing areas. And that's by people who don't really understand warm growing areas in the Southeast at all. Because our rains come so quick, so soon in the summer, and things deteriorate really badly as summer gets here. We have a dry period that is good for garlic and much easier for dealing with pulling garlic. Usually it occurs in April and May and early June. Usually. We're getting a little rain today, maybe in some parts of South Alabama, but there's a good chance we'll get some dry periods. And you want to go ahead and pull that garlic. Go ahead and feel around. Johnny, did you pull yours? Feel around that bulb. Your soil, if it's going to produce good garlic, you should be able to put your fingers down into the soil and feel the bulb. Just test one. And if it looks like it's bulbing up pretty good and you pull it up and lo and behold, it has bulbed up pretty well, I might recommend that this is the time of year when you ought to go ahead and pull them. A lot of times we wait for the leaves to brown. And when you get a lot of leaves browning out, then you pull them up. But all in all, I would pull them up when the soil is not too wet and during our dry periods. And in most cases, I would recommend pulling it before June. With most varieties, you would. Some of the longer producing varieties, you'll have to wait till June or July to pull them even. And you'll find that those don't do well here. At least in South Alabama for sure, and not so well in North Alabama either. So just be cautious about that. Look for those bulbs. Feel around, and Alicia has a beautiful crop, Alicia. That is absolutely beautiful. Nice big bulbs, lots of them. Now you've got to hang them. And Alicia, let's talk about what to do with the garlic once we get to this stage. So we've pulled the garlic. What are we going to do with it? Put it in a place where it's getting lots of airflow. Lots of airflow. That's very important. You really want it to dry out as quickly as it can. A lot of people say to leave the roots on. And I used to take that advice from growers out in Oregon, however they say it out there, or Washington State, where it gets really dry on the eastern side of the state, really dry, where they're growing this garlic. And they find if you just leave the roots on, it's just fine. But I find the roots actually tend to draw moisture into the bulb, makes it harder to dry. You might want to cut most of those roots off. You might not cut all of them off. It's probably too early to pull it off, but you might trim some of those roots after a couple of weeks. But hang the garlic up, let it dry out as well as you can, and keep them. I hang them up so that the bulbs are really don't all hang with each other, but just hang them up so that they're nice and spread out so that the bulbs get plenty of air circulation. And you can leave it like that for several weeks before trimming and bringing inside. We'll be back.
Traveling through this world alone, there is no sickness, toil, or danger in that fair land to which I go. I'm going home to see my mother. I'm going home no more to roam. I'm just going over Jordan. I'm just going over home.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right. Here we go. So Johnny in Grand Bay says he hasn't pulled his garlic yet. It's too pretty. I appreciate that, Johnny. I pulled some of my garlic and thought, God, this other, it's so pretty. Maybe it's going to grow a little more. And it looks so good in the garden. It's nice to come out and see it. Well, we'll see. I mean, I'm going to have to, I need to use that space eventually. I'm going to put okra where I have my garlic. So it's not too late to plant okra. In fact, it's kind of a fine time. It's kind of a fine time. I got lots of things going on. Don't want too big a garden space because you have to manage it all. We're going to make it work. Johnny has another technique, and I have not seen this before. Johnny turns his rake upside down. Is that right, Johnny? And pulls it through the grass and St. Augustine, and it pulls out the dollar weed leaves. That's interesting. Interesting technique. And keeps it from competing with the St. Augustine. One of the interesting things is that usually that dollar weed begins to decline with fall. And anytime we have some dry weather, it really begins to decline. So you'll see a big resurgence in early spring. Usually it begins to kind of slow down in May, late April, May, and June, because it usually dries out. And then there may be a brief resurgence in July because the rain starts, but then in August and September it declines again. Just my experience. And just doing a little bit, as Johnny's doing, may just to sort of grab it during these, when it's a nuisance, may be all you need to do. But an interesting technique. Interesting technique. Let's see, what else we got? We had a, let me get back to this picture. This is what Alicia grew blossom. And let me talk about garlic real quickly one more time for those of you who don't know. Alicia followed my advice on turban garlic. And it's the turbans that tend to do really well in South Alabama. I'm experimenting with others, but the turbans are consistently good, turban garlics. And so they produce quickly, and most of those turban garlics, not all of them, but most of them, are from wet climates. Blossom seems to do consistently well, and it's because it's from South China. Thai Fire usually does pretty well, and guess where it's from? Thai Purple. Chinese Purple seems to be from farther north in China. It does okay. And there's some others. I'll think of them here in just a minute. But turban garlics are the ones that I tend to focus on, and you can play with it. Blossom has been one that's been consistently good. The Thai garlics have been consistently good, even in South Alabama. As you move north in the state, or if you're in areas that are a little drier, that dry out a little better this time of year, you can grow other garlics, and particularly if you have longer winters, if we have a nice long winter. But we're getting, you know, people aren't getting, we're getting these cold outbreaks, but we're not getting long winters. And a lot of garlics need long, consistent winters to really produce well. So again, focusing on those garlics from Southeast Asia, it's the way we should go. They're going to be the best. And there are a few exceptions to that, but not many. So focus on those turban garlics. And Alicia did, and boy, she got a great crop. I love those turban garlics. They are, some of them are quite hot. And that's really fun. Now you cook them and they mellow out, but they still have a lot of flavor. A lot of flavor. Really fun to cook with. All right, so let me get to this picture from Kathy. Kathy, the picture came through multiple times. I don't know what's happening today with the internet. Things seem to be moving very slowly through the wires. Maybe it's all this solar stuff, or maybe it's just the way it always is. I don't know. The plant you have has many names and no names. It's funny. I don't even know what people call it locally. We don't really seem to have a name. In the books, when you go read a book, it's called Chinese Flame Tree, is the name you most often see. It's in a genus called Coleopteria, and please don't make me spell it. Just look up Chinese Flame Tree, and you'll see Coleopteria. This is Coleopteria, either elegans or bipinnata, and it's often hard for me to tell the difference, and I'm not going to try to distinguish. Both of them, whichever species it is, they're both called Chinese Flame Tree. They're both pretty invasive. And so they show up in various places. They're pretty. They're very pretty in fall. I've heard them called, you know, people are always trying to sell a product, so they always change the name to remind you of something else, like butterfly tree or butterfly bush. I don't know how many different butterfly bushes there are out there. It's just, you know, somebody thought, that's a good name. You know, I bet I can sell a lot of plants if I call it that. So this one is sometimes called bougainvillea tree because the flowers look like bougainvillea. Or the seed pods, I should say, look like bougainvillea. And if it stopped there, it would be fine, but those seed pods each contain a seed, and each of those seeds can come up quite aggressively. The story is you don't want that tree where it is, for sure. It's going to grow very fast, and it will be a problem around the house. You don't want to keep it there. I just would be generally cautious about keeping it because the seeds can be a bit of a nuisance, and it's becoming a problem. But that is a Chinese flame tree. Chinese flame tree. How do I know it's a Chinese flame tree? Because of something very distinctive about it. Did you notice, Kathy, that the leaves, well, each leaf is one of those long fronds. It's like the leaf is composed of many leaflets. And you'll notice that each frond not only has a leaf coming off the main stem, it has a stem coming off the main stem and leaves coming off of that. And what that means is it's bipinnate. That means twice like a feather, if you can imagine. So it's like each leaf is divided into a feather-like or fern-like frond, and each one of the subdivisions of that leaf has little leaflets on it. It's really complicated. It's bipinnately compound, we call it. But that makes it very easy. There aren't many that look like that. There aren't many trees that look like that, and that's what it is. If you need any more information, you give me a call, and we'll sort it out. We will sort it out. Let's see here. What else have we got? Just music. That's the end of our first hour. Hey, we're going to be back. I know I've got some questions about zucchini. We're going to talk about that. John, I see your question mark. I think you want to know what that plant is. We're going to help you out. as soon as we come back. And we're also going to check out this lamb.
It's Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast with Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Hey, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning. We're hearing a little bit of an echo. There we go. Sorry about that interruption. We are back. And my mother wanted me to ask you, what is your favorite Mother's Day flower? Well, you know, people often ask me, do I have a favorite flower? And I can't say that I do. I focus on various flowers at various times. If I want to eat flowers, I often think of nasturtium flowers. If I think about just ornate flowers, I think about orchid flowers, like our native orchids, like Kentucky Lady Slipper, which is just a fabulous flower and really interesting. When buckeyes bloom, I love what buckeyes do to me. I can't describe why I like buckeye flowers so much. All of them. I like hydrangeas. I like roses. I think basswood flowers are very interesting. I like the flowers of beggar sticks. They're incredible. I don't have a favorite flower. They're all neat. I've really begun to appreciate grass flowers. Does that agree with what my mother likes? No, probably not. I don't know what to say about it. I don't know how to answer those questions. Johnny wants to clarify that he pushes the rake through dollar weed with the tines turned up. And I'm guessing the pushing action grabs that. It sort of hangs up. So it may take certain types of rakes to do it. Johnny's using a metal rake that has little bands across it, I can see. And I guess they're capturing the dollar weed as he's pushing it. I would have thought he dragged it, but he's not. And I see now why you would do that. John in Grand Bay, who sent me a question mark with a plant. John, what you have is a century plant emerging. Agave. It's an agave. You know, like tequila, right? Agaves make some types of agaves. The juice is extracted, and they're used to make a variety of products, including a syrup, an agave syrup, and lots of drinks that are made with it as well. The century plant that you have will probably not produce in any quantities. But it will get very big. It's a century plant. It's called a century plant. John, you may know this because it was said to take a century to bloom, and it doesn't take a century to bloom. That's because somebody grew it in England where it was very unhappy, and it took a century there to bloom. It really only takes somewhere around 10 to 25 years. Somewhere in there, it's going to bloom. And when it does, it's going to produce a major stalk that is going to be very impressive. And you're going to be really, really impressed by it. It'll be a while, though. It'll be a while. Meanwhile, you're going to have those big leaves, and they're going to get bigger and bigger, and it's going to be a big crown, probably about 4 to 6 feet wide. Just to let you know. All right. Yeah. And so the person who sent me the apples said they can't listen to the show today. I did answer. But there's a few questions I need. Before I can answer more questions about the apples. Let's see. What else we got? The zucchini. Let me get to the zucchini real quick. So someone sent me a picture of a zucchini, and the bottom end of that zucchini, and you'll see this on squash as well, was like it was rotting out. Well, it may remind you of something called tomatoes when they rot on their bottom. Blossom end rot, it's called. The bottoms of those tomatoes will rot out. In all cases, it's the result of frequent changes in water. So it basically what's happening at core is that the uneven watering, which could be the result of too much rain, gets too much rain at one time, not quite enough at other times, or just too much rain in general, disrupts the movement of nutrients through the plants. And so the nutrients don't move through the plants very well, if you diagnose it, it's a lack of calcium in the base of the plant, and the plant begins to rot out. But it's not really a calcium deficiency, it's just a water issue. One of the ways to do that is to build super soil where you have plenty of organic matter that drains well, and that also doesn't get too wet, so it doesn't get too wet when it rains, but also holds on to moisture, which is kind of the nice thing about super soil. Plenty of organic matter. We can talk about how to make that work. But, yeah, that's what's happened. And it was, you know, result of heavy rains, basically, perhaps followed by not quite enough moisture, you know, not quite enough watering. But don't berate yourself. It's really not about how you water. It's about how we get too much rain sometimes. And the only way to deal with that is to build super soil. And I'll come back and talk about that here in just a minute. Clay, I am listening to him too. What are you hearing around Birmingham?
I live just south of Birmingham, but my hometown is Montevallo, and I was there on Thursday and Friday of this week, and it was the most eerie experience I think I've ever had. The cicadas were throwing up a sound that the only way I can describe it is like if a spaceship had landed on the other side of the woods, and it was just this eerie kind of sound, and you would hear it anywhere in town. Doesn't matter where you go, you hear it everywhere, particularly where there's heavy stands of hardwood trees. And
right.
I was told that it was so bad last Saturday when they tried to have outdoor graduation that it almost interrupted graduation at the college.
Clay, can you hold on? Can you come? Sure. Can you hold on while I do this little ad series? And
sure.
We'll be right back.
Okay.
Me and my best friend Lillian in her blue Jaguar dog Gideon, sitting on the front porch, cooling in the shed, singing every song the radio played, waiting for the Alabama sun to go down to red dirt girls in a red dirt town, me and Lillian.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Charlie, you see, he's still with us. Charlie's back today. Great to have him back. Great to talk to him. And all of our producers and hosts torture us with Tiny Tim. It's still here. It's still here. Someone sent me a picture of a century plant in bloom. I wish I could send this on to you. The person who's asking about the century plants. But I wanted to get back to Clay. Clay was talking about an almost supernatural experience that people are having in many parts of Alabama. Clay said, just to repeat what Clay was saying, he's been listening to these cicadas. These are the periodic cicadas, not the cicadas we normally get year to year, though those cicadas are out there too. This is a big explosion that happens right at about every 13 years. My experience with this, Clay, my last experience was in 2011. I was in the Red Hills of Monroe County, and it was just eerie. It was absolutely eerie. And Clay is describing it in the same way. He said the Montevallo graduation was just about disrupted because of the sound of these cicadas. I've heard several people describe this like a spaceship. It is a kind of it sounds like a rotating disc, right?
Right.
So a whirring sort of hollow rotating disc sound. It's hard to,
one of the things you have heard on Star Trek.
right. And, you know, maybe on the Star Trek, they actually would use, I don't know, where did they, could they have gotten the sound from these periodic cicadas? But it is a whirring, sort of a hollow sound as well. And it's very interesting. It's the sound of hundreds of thousands of these cicadas in the trees. I was looking yesterday at a box elder, and I just looked up in the box elder, and it was astonishing. I mean, there were thousands of these cicadas in that box elder flying in and out, all trying to attract mates during this relatively brief period. So do you find the sound painful, Clay?
No, it's just so unusual to be in a forested area, and anywhere you go, it's just there. It doesn't go away at all.
Yeah. I have been trying, and I was having an argument, not an argument, just a questioning some, how do we understand these cicadas better? My thought is that I'm hearing the sound better on the edges of forest than in the deep forest. Now, there's some disagreement about that. I've been in both places, and I'm hearing the sound, but it's much louder, and therefore I think there are more cicadas where the forest edge up to a pasture or edge up to an open area. Have you been around enough to notice that?
Yeah, I think that perfectly describes the situation in Montevallo, where there are a lot of heavily wooded areas that come up to open areas around town, and all you have to do is kind of get close to one of those, and the sound gets louder. In particular, the college there has a lake, and I drove by it, and just all around that lake, it was just deafening.
Yes, and it is exceptional. So these cicadas live on the roots of trees, so they're not going to be far from trees. They don't apparently live off the roots of pine trees at all. My feeling is that they're probably pretty selective about the type of hardwoods they use. But no one's really focused on that. I'm not sure. It's got to be interesting. I think maples are probably a preferred, and particularly the soft maples is my bet, are preferred, probably because they may have fewer protections. They don't have a good immune system, the soft maples, and maybe things like black cherries don't have a good immune system. And so they may be more susceptible, to these guys because the cicadas live on the roots for 13 years and deep underground.
At least for what they're doing right now, they seem to be in really mature oak trees. So, you know, they have a lot of area to land on and so on.
Is it a red oak or is it a white
oak?
Does it make any difference?
Probably mostly red oak forest, yeah.
Yeah,
but it's
so
like
that's
you were describing. It just comes up to open areas. It borders open areas.
Yeah, so there's lots to learn about these guys. And you know, we only have about 4 weeks out of every out of every 13 years to sort of figure out what they're doing. And the sound is just remarkable. It's everywhere I go now, where my farm is and where we're working on the research center. It's just everywhere. But I don't think it's as intense deep in the woods. On the edges of the woods and next to the river, where the river makes a sort of gallery, it's really intense, and the numbers of cicadas, and they really haven't reached their peak yet where I am. I think maybe they're beginning to peak around Montevallo, and that, but they're still not quite peaking where I am, and so there's a lot to hear. There'll be a lot left to hear, but it's just it's a constant sound.
Just keep your windows closed when you try to sleep.
I don't mind the sound. I don't find it, and I don't think it's as loud at night as it is during the day.
Yeah, that surprised me. I didn't expect it to be that loud during the day, and it really was.
And it's the day when they're calling, and they seem to respond. You know, I noticed when they're just getting started, it's less prominent now. When the clouds would come over, the sound would die off. And then when the clouds... when the clouds disappeared, it just started again. And I'm trying to understand that. But they seem to be stimulated by sunlight, which is odd because you'd think that with the sounds like they're making that, it seems that they wouldn't depend on sunlight, but they seem to be stimulated by it in some ways. Something else I don't understand. I'm going to spend more time thinking about whether I'm hearing them at night, but they didn't interfere with my sleep last night at all. I did hear a sort of a deep, distant roar, but not quite as intense as it is during the day. So, well, Clay, I'm so glad you called.
Well, if I've never heard a dynamo that generates electricity, but I imagine it sounds a lot like that.
Yes, it would, but it sounds like a warp drive dynamo, right?
Right. So, right. Absolutely.
It's just
a very, very strange natural phenomenon to experience, for sure.
Yeah, it's science fiction. You know, you feel so honored to be able to hear it. You know, we talk about things like solar eclipses, and people get on jets to go look at solar eclipses. But man, this is the thing to hear. It's definitely incredible.
Once in a lifetime, for sure.
And I don't even know if it's what's so cool about it is that it becomes just part of the tapestry of life here. It's not just, oh, let me get on a jet to go hear that. It really is this thing of living with it day after day with just the sound, and the birds are going berserk because these guys are really good to eat. lots of other creatures are beginning to eat them. They're going to fatten up. I was looking, if I can say it out loud, Charlie keeps score on this, so I have to be careful. I was looking at coyote poop, and there he goes. You see what I'm saying? So we're looking at this coyote thing, and it was full of cicadas. So the coyotes are out eating. Everything is eating. The raccoons, whatever. It's just cicada abundance. What an incredible experience. What an incredible time.
Well, I knew you'd like to hear about it.
Yeah, it was really good to hear from you, Clay, and really good to hear about it. How's your garden doing?
Beans are looking good. Tomatoes are looking good. So thumbs up.
All right. Good. Good to hear from you, Clay. Call us more often.
Thank you.
All right. There you go. I am so glad. You know, I talked a lot about the cicadas last week. I was reluctant to talk about them this week, but I am so glad Clay made us talk about it. The individual sound of these cicadas is different. I mean, if you were listening to each cicada, the sound would be one way. But when you have millions of them, the sound is this bizarre thing. And what's sorry, what's even more interesting is the fact that it seems to is that you actually have more than one cicada making the sound, so each one's making a different sound. It's just a remarkable experience. What else have we got here? It's we're coming up on the half hour. I wanted to hit a few things. The blueberry bush with a little bit of spotting on it, probably from overhead watering. It's not a big deal. I wouldn't worry about the fungicide. I would try to avoid overhead watering, which may be causing part of the problems, and it could be just a relic from being in a nursery. Not a big deal. Wouldn't worry about it. What else we got? We got several things. I'm going to come back and get to them. Oh, that's a beautiful thing from David B. up in on the Cahaba River. We're going to talk about that when we come back.
Sugar magnolia blossoms blooming. That's all that you have, don't care.
So my baby down by the river,
we should have to come up soon for dear.
Sweet blossom, come on.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, welcome back. So, just in general, some blueberry leaf diseases can be serious. But I would say, to get back to this blueberry rond and foley, make sure you're getting really good air circulation. And if you're watering from overhead, don't do that. Water from water. One of the things you can do, I don't know how blueberries are going to do in a container. I think it's done, and it can be done. I'm sure it can be done. Make sure you got the right soil. You're going to have to fertilize it. But try to water it from underneath. Have a pan that you put it in. Blueberries don't like a deep container. They actually don't need a deep container at all. Just a moderately deep container. But what they won't really want is a wide container. So make your container as wide as possible. And water from underneath. Water from underneath, and make sure they get plenty of sunlight and air circulation. And I don't think you'll have a problem there. Let's see what else. Don, I misunderstood your question, and I'm sorry. Sometimes I have to read quickly on the air to read the questions so that I can give the right answers, and sometimes I don't see everything. Don wanted to know what was my mother's favorite daylily flower, and I haven't kept up with it, Don, so I don't know. I will tell you, the one thing I do know about daylilies is that the ones my mother can grow in central Alabama are generally different than the ones that can be grown in areas farther north, and they may be different than the ones that can be grown in Mobile. And it's just, there's a lot of diseases out there. There are a lot of issues. And so it's hard to say that one daylily variety is perfect for every place. I do know that much. And I don't know. So the one in front of the Satori coffee house, the agave, I am told, took 25 years exactly to bloom. And it looks alien as well, doesn't it? The blooms on these, so we're talking about century plants, the blooms on these things, and I used to get pictures a lot when I worked for the newspaper, and people said, what is this? Now they go on Facebook and ask somebody in Minnesota, what is this? And the people in Minnesota say, I don't know. Because they don't have, the century plants don't survive up there. They do survive here quite well, and they spread around even from seeds. But again, it can take a long time for that century plant to bloom. And this one took a quarter century, 25 years exactly, we are told. I believe you. And the stalk is the size, how wide with it looks like, I'm trying to think of something that would be about that size. It's just immense. It's the size, it's like a flagpole. It's like a flagpole emerging from the middle of this thing, and it's already about, I'm guessing, about 8 feet tall. It's not even near the height that it will be. It should be 12, maybe 15 feet tall by the time it's ready to bloom. It's spectacular. It's weird. It's so big, it's just weird. And, you know, it's, you don't even say, you forget to say it's beautiful because it's so big. And it is beautiful in its own way. It is beautiful, but it's just big when it finally blooms. And when it blooms, the plant dies. The mother plant dies, but she will often produce little babies at the tips of her roots. And then you kind of start over again. It spends a lot, century plants spend a lot of time producing this massive stalk. The mother plant dies, and then you've got babies made in more than one way. Let's see. We've gotten that. Good. Let's see. We've got, what else have we got? I did want to come back to David Bracken. David B. has been up in, said he heard the same cicadas Clay was talking about. He was around Montevallo on the Cahaba and really enjoying the Cahaba River at the National Wildlife Refuge yesterday. It is a beautiful place. That flower you have, Clay, is something called Smallanthus, Smallanthus. It's related to a South American vegetable called yacón, I think is how you would pronounce it, yacón, and which is also a member of the Smallanthus genus. What is bear's foot is a common name for it, though I don't hear anybody calling it that. It just doesn't seem to really tell the story of the plant very well. Was formerly listed in the leaf cup family. It's not in the leaf cup genus. It's not anymore. I don't know what you call it, but it's one of our great neglected plants. We ought to have, maybe if we had a better name for it, beautiful big yellow flowers that look like sunflowers. It's a member of the aster family. Quite beautiful, quite neat, really cool plant. The leaves are really interesting too. And if you look at the leaves, you kind of get the barefoot imagery. Kind of. Any rate, it's a really interesting plant. David says, I don't talk enough about rivers. And I do talk a little bit about rivers. In my defense, but not enough. I agree. And I need to talk about rivers more. I'll say this over and over. There's so many ways to think about rivers in Alabama. I hope they survive. I hope our diversity survives. We are the center of aquatic diversity, river diversity, if you will, in North America. By far. I often like to say, you know, a river in Alabama, even a river like the Cahaba, could have 2.5 times as many species as the entire state of California. It's just remarkable. It's remarkable. A single river. And there are many rivers. I don't think there is a significant river in the state that doesn't have close to twice as many fish species as the entire state of California. It can be really, really just immense and really cool. So it's just something to think about. the mussel diversity here is just, as nearly as I can tell, and somebody proved me wrong, there Alabama represents, oh, probably just a tiny fraction, much less than 1/200th of the land mass of the United States. And yet, we have more mussel diversity than all of South America. So how do we, you know, those are numbers. And they don't really tell you, it's just this thing we take for granted when you get in these rivers and there is so much diversity. We expect other rivers to have that. We expect, you know, we have turtles. Alabama is the center of turtle diversity in the Western Hemisphere. And how do we, you know, but we can barely comprehend that because it's what we've grown up with. But it is huge, and it would be, the world will miss something when we lose the diversity of Alabama rivers. I'll talk more about them. We're gonna talk more about them, David, because they're so interesting. And you can't just redirect a river through your garden. I recognize that. But what we talk about is where you are and where we are and what's so important about it and how you live with it, how you interact with it. And that goes beyond just your garden. That goes beyond just your garden. All right, what else we got? Let's see. I think I'm just about caught up on these messages. What have we got? Any others? A fun question. I have heatless jalapenos planted, lots of deer, lots of coon nature around us. With my wife and I come out to harvest the early fruits, they were gone. Do deer or raccoons eat jalapeno peppers? Well, they might. It would take some training for them to do it, but they certainly might. If I do think they were eating the peppers, I think they would eat the rest of the plant as well. I don't know. Does wildlife respond to heat in the same way people do? I think generally, one of the reasons peppers, if you could think of why would peppers bother with this heat thing? So, I mean, they could pass on the genes for the heat thing or not. And if it was costing them a lot of effort to create capsicum, whatever, this chemical that produces the heat, if it took a lot of energy to produce it, I'm sure it does, they could just say, I don't need that anymore. And genetically, it might not get passed on as well. But as a matter of fact, the plants that are producing the capsicum are more likely to produce, may produce more and more of it over time because it is very effective at doing something. And what is it effective at doing? Maybe there are several benefits. But one of the benefits is that birds seem to be completely immune to the effects of capsicum. It doesn't bother them at all. And birds are also attracted to red. So you may have noticed a lot of peppers turn red when they're mature. And so what's going on there? Well, maybe these peppers want to attract birds who see red really well so that the birds will move those peppers around to other places. But The capsicum discourages mammals and other things that might not distribute that as well. And mammals are really susceptible to it. Kind of cool, isn't it? So, but we got used to the capsicum, which we often do. We'll come back, maybe we talk a little bit about that.
My old hen is a good old hen. She lays eggs for the railroad men. Sometimes one, sometimes 10. That's enough for the railroad men. Look, old hen, look and sing. You ain't laid an egg since away last spring. Look, old hen, look and squall. You ain't laid an egg since away.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, here we go. Yeah, so David is saying somebody's been writing about the century plant at Satori, and that it was 29 years old. I'm not going to get in the middle of this argument. It looks like a huge asparagus for the Jolly Green Giant, David Hubble says. Yeah, it does. You know, it's really interesting that because there's always one blooming somewhere in Mobile. It's just every year. I can tell you that because every year I would get a picture of a century plant blooming. It may be that more as our yards become more and more Home Depot, Walmart, Lowe's yards, where you only have a few boring plants to plant, we won't see that happen every year because people won't be planting century plants anymore. But in the old days when people had many interesting plants to plant, there were a lot of century plants. And so you would get one blooming, maybe several blooming in many years. Sometimes I think drought or other things would trigger a blooming. But an interesting thing. Interesting thing. If anybody can tell me what goatweed is, and it doesn't help you, you won't be, it doesn't help you to look this up on the internet because you're going to get a plant called Epimedium, which I won't go into why it shows up so much on the internet, which is not something that we have here at all. So I'm not sure if it's one of the things with common names is everybody gets to use their own common names, but not everybody knows what you're talking about. And I create my own common names too. It's really fun too, but sometimes you just have to explain what it is you're talking about. Alicia has got this garlic thing figured out. I mean, she is so good at this. She's been growing. There's several things I got to brag on Alicia for doing. And I think Alicia has sort of become, I mean, our garlic gardening expert, in my opinion, because she's doing the whole nine yards. What she's got is she had a great crop of blossom, and then I'm watching how she's got it laid out, and she's got it laid out beautifully on some hog wire, but just a metal mesh. This is a rather open metal mesh, so that it dry, so that air can circulate from top and bottom, and she's got the garlic laid out that way, and she's letting it sit there, and she's got a fan blowing on it because, you know, it gets pretty humid here, and I think the fan is particularly useful at night, and she's letting it dry out that way, and it's really good. And because of this, she's able to save her garlic seed and replant it year after year. And Alicia says this is the fourth year with blossom. She's not rebuying it. I am so impressed, Alicia. I got to get some tips from you because you're doing it right. You're doing it really, really well. This is really good. Clay has got a short recording that he made at Montevallo. I wish I could play it for you guys. I don't think we're going to have time to get it on today, but we'll figure it out. And listen, the person who sent me the question about goatweed, I don't know what it is. Send me a picture of it. Can you send me a picture of it? And maybe I can understand what it is. Yeah, so it's not growing anymore. Yeah, it wouldn't be. So it dies. This is a century plant, and I'm getting a message that it's not growing anymore. The young ones are coming up around the mother plant. And I guess the spike is not growing anymore. The plant, I'm just... I'm having a hard time interpreting it, but we'll figure that one out. I'm not going to send people the story without asking them. So there we go. What else have I gotten to all the questions today? Well, except for the goat weed questions, which is really intriguing me. I will say that there are a lot of things going on in these seed mixes that people are planting that are not good. And a lot of those deer seed mixes, oh, I'm going to say this out loud. And Sean, my good friend, may or may not agree with me on this, but I'm pretty sure it's true. A lot of the seed mixes are contaminated with seeds that you don't want. They're even contaminated with seeds that nobody meant to be in there. And one of the reasons we're spreading this, we're spreading a weed called Perilla, which it came from many sources, and it comes off tires and everywhere else. I appreciate that, but I also think it's in seed mixes because it's really hard to keep out of those, out of poorly designed seed mixes, particularly if you're not burning your fields where you're getting your seed mixes, and most people aren't. So be very careful about what you plant in your wildlife fields because you don't know about it. We should talk more about that. We should have more discussions about it. It can be a big issue, and it's something we're dealing with and fighting even now. Well, interesting show this morning. Started out, I'm going to go make apologies to my mother because the only thing she wants, there's nothing she wants more than to have me walking through her garden right now. Well, she'd want me to wait till she got back from church. But she would want to take me through the garden. That's what she wants. And I'm not going to be there. I got radio shows to do. I've got other commitments. Things happen. And she's a ways away now. But, you know, mothers teach us a lot about gardening. My mother taught me. My great-grandmother taught me. My grandmother Finch taught me. My granddaddy Finch taught me. They all teach us a bit about gardening, but our mothers are pretty important. And Mother's Day is a good time to think about the mother that taught us all and from whom we should be learning a lot more. We forget about the mother that made this incredible space around us. It's a beautiful, incredible space. We have so much to learn from the native woods of Alabama, from the forest, from the grasslands and prairies, the rivers. We forget about that, and it's really where we should be learning. It's the visuals we should be learning to help us determine how our lawns look. It's the place where we should be getting our food from more often, learning about what are the new foods that we could be using. We've never really understood the diversity of Alabama. I say this over and over and over again. We don't understand that it is so diverse. And all of our impressions of Alabama, we listen to what other people tell us about what Alabama is. It's a state of kudzu. No, it isn't. It's a state of cotton. No, it isn't. Cotton is not even particularly, this is not a great state for cotton growing even. Let's get back to the woods. Let's get back to that mother. Hey, we'll be back next week.